Blog Talk Radio. Greetings. This is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Sunday, June the 16th, 2024. We are broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We would like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special edition of our program. Later on, we'll be bringing you our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on a number of issues, including the statement made by the Republic of South Africa Vice President to the youth of the country on the future prospects for employment and economic opportunities in South Africa. There are two banks which have collapsed in the East African state of Kenya. We'll have details on that as well. Displacement has escalated on the African continent. And the United Nations peacekeeping troops in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo have expanded their operations. In the second and third hours, we continue our commemoration of Black Music Month with focuses on jazz artist Lee Morgan and Kenny Burrell of Detroit. We'll take our musical interlude with the legendary Mbilia Bell from the Democratic Republic of Congo to give you some background information on this tremendous and legendary artist. Marie-Claire Mboyo Moseka, professionally known as Mbilia Bell, was born on January 10th of 1959. She is a Congolese rumba and soukous singer and songwriter. She is known as the Queen of African Rumba. She rose to fame after first being discovered by Sam Mangwana and later by Tabule Rashuru, who helped her gain confidence, master her powerful soprano voice, and achieve acclaim as one of the best Congolese female singers. Bell became successful at a young age, inspired by her father, who played guitar. She joined the local church choir, where her artistry for singing expeditiously became conspicuous. At the age of 17, Bell began her performing career, singing as a backup singer for Abete Masekini, the queen of perfumed soukous, and later with Sam Mangwana. In the late 1980s, she caught the attention of Tabule Rashuru, who recognized her natural vocal abilities. Rashuru took her to join his band, Orchestra Afrisa Internationale, and became her mentor in 1981. As Tabule's protege, she leveraged his composing genius and her own voice to produce many hits for the Orchestra Afrisa Internationale. In 1981, Bell soared to prominence with the release of her debut solo album entitled Isiwe Yo Wapi with Orchestra Afrisa Internationale. In 1982, she released her second song with Afrisa, Pevi Yalongo, Holy Spirit in Kikongo, a moving song about spousal abuse. In the song, she tells the story of a woman who had been abandoned by her husband and has to raise her children herself. The song was popular, especially among women in what is now known as the Democratic Republic of Congo. In the mid-1980s, she officially married Tabule. The birth of her first child prompted her to take a break from performing. However, she reunited with Rashuru for an album in 1987 before eventually relocating to Paris in 1988. There, she started working with guitarist Rigo Star Bamundele, and between 1989 and early 1990, she toured the United States, Great Britain, and West Africa. During this time, Tabule recruited another female artist, Kishila Ngoyi, known as Faye Tess, to accompany Bell. The Afrisa Internationale continued to achieve success with their tour to Kenya, Tanzania, and Rwanda, resulting in several hit albums. After her departure from the Orchestra Afrisa Internationale, both the band's popularity and Bell's solo career experienced a change. However, She made a triumphant comeback in 2004 with the release of her album Bellissimo, meaning very beautiful in Italian. The album received excellent reviews. And let's listen to Emilia Bell. This is taken from an album entitled Phenomeny. Let's listen in to this classic composition.
Love it. Kati ya mzoto makilo ya kutanganga feluje Maya vale Thank you.
Welcome back, and that was the music of Imbilia Bell from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and this is Black Music Month, the month of June. And Imbilia Bell, of course, as we mentioned earlier, played an instrumental role in the development of Congolese and Pan-African music during the 1980s and since that time period. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast, this special edition of our program for Sunday, June 16th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. These are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. In South Africa, Deputy President Paul Mashatile has assured young people that the 7th administration will make significant inroads in addressing youth unemployment. Mashatile made this commitment during the government's Youth Day commemoration event in Polokwane earlier today. This is to commemorate the anniversary, the 48th anniversary of the June 16th uprising in South Africa in 1976. The latest quarterly labor force survey has shown that over 45% of young people remain without jobs. However, Mashatile said that the government of national unity will curb the scourge of youth unemployment. He said that, quote, "We will continue to address the challenges facing young people in this country. In this regard, we will, in the next 5 years, focus on creating jobs, building an inclusive and growing economy. We will equally focus on implementing a program that focuses on skills for the youth with skills for the future." In the East African state of Kenya, the Kenya Deposit Insurance Corporation, the KDIC, is set to wind up two collapsed lenders, RE Bank and Reliance Bank, serving the last rites for the institutions under liquidation for decades now. Winding up is the process of dissolving a business by liquidating stock, paying creditors, and distributing any remaining shareholder assets. On Thursday, the Kenyan Deposit Insurance Corporation requested proposals on the provision of legal and audit services for the wind-up of the banks. RE Bank Corporation Limited has been in liquidation since December 5th of 1997 and had 287,000, that's some $2,238 U.S. dollars in total deposits. As at the end of June 2021, the KDIC reported it had paid out 55% of the institution's protected deposits, or 6,000 shillings, some $46.80, from a pool of 11,000 Kenya shillings, which is $85.08 in protected deposits. Similarly, the KDIC disclosed the payment of $45 million, that is $351 million U.S. dollars, to uninsured depositors and creditors at the end of the same period. Reliance Bank Limited was placed in liquidation in September of 2000 and had 969,000 Kenyan shillings, some 7,483 U.S. dollars in total deposits. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In other news, Africa's conflicts are turning out to be the biggest stumbling blocks to achieving sustainable development goals, the SDGs, drawing back the continent from its often praised colorful economic promise. That assessment is drawn from two separate reports launched this week on the global trends of conflicts and the attendant human displacement from it, as well as the burden of reconstructing destroyed livelihoods. In Africa, global trends show that the root causes of displacement are human rights violations, risk of persecution, conflict, poor governance, and loss of livelihoods. That is also Goal 16 of the Sustainable Development Goals, which seek to build just and well-governed societies that protect human rights. The report by the United Nations Refugee Agency Global Trends, Forced Displacement in 2023 shows that overall, the world has reported 117.3 million people as displaced. The number could rise to 124 million as a result of persecution, conflict, violence, human rights violations, or events seriously disturbing public order, unquote. And Africa has contributed the biggest number of displacements in the past year, even though it has fewer conflicts now compared to 20 years ago. That is giving a burden to humanitarian responders, but is just a tougher task as well for peace mediators. In 2023, after the outbreak of the war in the Republic of Sudan, the number of Sudanese refugees surged by 79% to 1.5 million. The biggest surge in Africa, they fled the neighboring Chad, South Sudan, Egypt, and in Ethiopia. And finally, in this Pan-African Newswire segment, UN peacekeepers have started deploying troops in more areas in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo to deal with a new wave of violence from various groups. Farhan Haq, deputy spokesman for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, said on Wednesday that the decision to deploy troops came after members of the Zaire and Kodeko armed groups clashed at a mining site about 40 kilometers from Bunia in Ituri province. According to the latest report by the United Nations experts, the war has escalated partly because of the actions of the voluntary combatants for the defense of the homeland, Wazalendo, fighting against the rebels, are also becoming a source of insecurity for civilians. Wazalendo have often claimed they are defending their homeland and are fighting against the M23 in North Kivu province. The government has since banned them from carrying weapons in Goma, the provincial capital. Quote, "We have taken a number of decisions, and particularly we no longer want to see any voluntary combatants for the defense of the homeland," the Wazalendo group, "in town with a weapon," said Major General Peter Krimwami Nkuba, military governor of North Kivu, while the government says those opposed to foreign interference should be supported. It, too, is concerned about the atrocities. With that, we'll conclude our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. In concluding this segment, we would like to remind our listeners, the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so that you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, the special worldwide radio broadcast, go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
I can feel it, but I can't.
the voice of Tina Turner with the track entitled Two People. And this is Black Music Month, and right now we're going to go into a rare archival interview, radio interview with Lee Morgan from 1969. Lee Morgan, of course, the absolutely amazing trumpet player who recorded with many of the great jazz leaders of the 1950s and 1960s. Let's listen to this interview with Lee Morgan.
Good evening. Welcome to All Night Jazz. This is Dan McCloskey. I'll be here for 1 hour tonight with a special 1 hour program. Tonight we'll hear an interview with jazz trumpeter Lee Morgan. Sidewinder with Lee Morgan. We're over here at the Bothan Jazz Club. We're talking to Lee Morgan. You hear the Sidewinder in the background now. That's probably one of your biggest hits, isn't it? Would you say?
Yes, Dan, that is the biggest. I still collect royalties on it. It's had about 30 different artists that have done it since I've done it. There's lyrics to it, and Woody Herman, among others, have done the lyric version. I didn't write the lyrics myself. The lyrics were written by, they're pretty well-known lyricists in New York, Hugo and Luigi. And I had maybe three or four people give me samples, and I settled on theirs. And like I said, it's about, I would say, at least six or seven lyric versions
uh-huh.
out of the whole thing, and roughly about maybe 8 or 9 instrumental versions other than mine. Quincy Jones has done it. James Brown's has an album out where just his band plays different selections. They do it. Hugo Winterhalter and strings. Like I said before, Woody Herman. The Double Six did it in Paris. It's been quite I had it on a commercial, you know, a couple of years
That's
ago.
That's right, yeah.
For
it was during
the Chrysler product.
World Series, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, during the football games and, you know, the Dodge Rebellion wants you, that thing. But it's been a very, very nice to meet that too.
How has it affected your gigs, you know, playing around?
Well, you know, that kind of like started the ball rolling, really, because at that time, I had rejoined the Jazz Messengers after taking Freddie Hubbard's place, who had originally taken my place. You know, I played in the Jazz Messengers for 3 years, and then after I left, Freddie took my place, and he played for roughly around the same amount of time. And then when he left kind of like very suddenly, you know, and
mm-hmm.
Art asked me would I come in at least until he can get someone else. And I ended up staying in the band for another close to 2 years. And during that time is when the Sidewinder came out.
That was so, about 64, right?
Yeah, 64, late 64, early 65. And it kind of started the ball rolling, and it was, I think, the most important thing I had in helping me to start my own little thing going with my own group.
Uh-huh. You played with Dizzy Gillespie, right?
Yeah, well, that was...
That was a long time ago.
The original... my original solo flight, you know, like the first time the chick left and left was with Dizzy. I was 18. I just turned 18. I was in the Philadelphia Conservatory. And that was the beginning of everything for me, the beginning of a wealth of experience that I got with the band and to be able to play with people like Wynton Kelly and Charlie Persip, Benny Golson, Quincy Jones, Ernie Wilkins, Phil Woods.
All these guys were in the band.
Right, everybody, you know. And,
wow.
It was a beautiful band. It was an interracial band, and everybody got along. It was never any problem, and I learned a whole lot, you know. It wasn't a big band. You have to blend with 16 or 17 other guys, you know, and you get a real feeling of community kind of a thing, you know. There's always somebody to hang out with.
A little segment of That's All with the Dizzy Gillespie Band, and you heard Lee Morgan soloing there. Sounded very good.
That was a long time ago. But, you know, it's a certain way that we, especially a brass man, has to solo with a big band. Because the band comes in behind you, you know, at times playing shout choruses and background and things, and you have to be strong enough to still be heard over all of that. You know, it's one thing when you're in a recording studio and they might have you all alone in a little booth with earphones on, you know. But when you're on the bandstand and you're back there and all you're doing is just standing up, you know, you haven't even come out to the front to the mic or something, then you really have to be powerful. And I noticed this is something that Dizzy always had. You know, no matter how strong and how loud the band was playing behind him, he would just soar all over the band, you know.
He would just take off.
Right. And this, it comes with time. You know, I think your lungs and everything just get stronger by playing in a brass section. I know mine did. In fact, they were probably stronger then than they probably would be now for that kind of a thing. Section work.
Was this recorded during that time with Dizzy, Just One of Those Things from the album The Cooker?
No, I think The Cooker was a little later. The Cooker was around the time that I joined Art Blakey. I would say around late 58, early 59. Because Hank Mobley, it was supposed to be Hank Mobley and myself.
Uh-huh. Right around the period, though, middle of 58 or so. Why don't we hear that? That's got a very nice feeling to it. You really, really played well on that thing. Just one of those things.
This is the first album that I actually wrote some original tunes for, that Numa and the Heavy Dipper. They were the first two tunes that were Lee Morgan originals that were recorded. That was my initial flight as a composer, jazz composer, Numa and Heavy Dipper.
Maybe we should play one of those.
Well, Just One of Those Things is a very exciting tune. It's Thursday Night Tunisia. We gave it a 6-8 kind of a thing. And Philly Joe Jones, as you see, I have Philly Joe and Paul Chambers. Had an all-star rhythm section, Bobby Timmons. And like I said, it was supposed to be Hank, but Hank couldn't make it, and I didn't want to cancel the date. And I just met Pepper Adams, and he was fantastic. I never heard anybody play a baritone like that, you know? And so at the last minute, we had to alter the music because it had been written for trumpet and tenor. And if you'll notice, on a lot of the tracks, he's playing way up in the top of his horn, trying to get the same kind of thing that it would have been if it had been a tenor.
Well, you heard two things there with Lee Morgan. Just One of Those Things, and then The Lion and the Wolf, written for
Alfred Lion and Frank Wolf, who were the owners of Blue Note Records.
Back in those days, it's still running.
Yeah, well, they sold the company about a year and a half ago to Liberty Records. And Alfred Lion, who was kind of like, he was the one who did most of the recording. Frank Wolf usually handled he took a lot of the pictures, and he was more or less the accountant, and you know, dealt with the figures. But they were equal partners in the venture. And when they decided to sell, Alfred had just remarried, and he just decided that was it for him. However, Frank Wolf is still with Blue Note Records.
He's producing it.
Right, he still does most of the record dates. And he still takes most of the pictures, and he's the last link with the old company. And this was a tribute to them. Since it's Alfred Lion and Frank Wolf, that's what I named the tune, The Lion and the Wolf.
It's kind of a neat thing there. Your group in San Francisco is really sounding excellent. Who is in your new group now?
Well, the group I have out here in San Francisco at present is Harold Mayburn, who is on the Gigolo album, and I have another one he's on, too. I don't think it's come out yet. And Frank Mitchell, who used to be a jazz messenger. I think he's on the album Buttercorn Lady. That was the group that Art had when he had Chuck Mangione, the trumpet player. And other than that, I think that's about the only thing Frank made up until the sessions that he's done with me. Now, this group has just recorded two albums, but it will be a little while before they come out because we just made them. Then I have Mickey Roker on the drums, Herbie Lewis on the bass, and that rounds things out. I double on flugelhorn at times, and Frank doubles on soprano saxophone. Although to come out here, I just brought my trumpet, and all he brought was his tenor.
Where are you doing most of your gigs these days? New York?
Yeah, well, we work New York. You know, a band has to stay on the road. Like they say, either appearing or disappearing.
Yeah.
We worked all the clubs in New York, and we worked Philadelphia, Boston, Chicago, Detroit, Washington. It just so happens that I think it just turned out that way. This just happens to be the first time that we've been, I would say, west of Chicago.
You were out here with the Art Blakey messengers,
yeah,
right?
I've been to California
a few years ago.
Maybe my eighth time out here.
But I mean, in within the last year.
As far as my group, this is the first time for my group, me as a leader.
The group is sounding even more vibrant than it does on your records. It's really alive.
Well, this particular group has, like I said before, you know, I have maybe one guy on one thing and maybe somebody else another album, but the particular group that I have now, I haven't had any albums come out with the personnel that I have at this moment. Now, we just made a few things, like I said before, but it hasn't been released yet.
Yeah. Where did you get your, I don't know what you'd call it, I don't know how to type it, like, take a track like Kaliso, has a very Latin sound to it, or African, or I really don't know what to say about it. I noticed this on a number of your compositions. This is one by you, written by you. Where does that come from? What influences that?
Well, that's a hard question. Well, you know, music just comes. When I write, you know, you can't force writing. It has to come. I just sit down and doodle around on the piano, and sooner or later something comes. Now, sometimes you can get a basic pattern and maybe write two or three different melodies, things that would be completely different in structure, but would be related harmonically, maybe, you know? But I usually try to make things sound different and try to have a well-rounded thing. I actually don't have any format for writing. It's just I just try to give them titles after I've composed them. The title is always usually last to come, you know, after.
Well, here, this one, Kaliso, I was reading the liner notes. It said something about African influence. Maybe that was Kariba.
Well, now you mentioned Calypso. Actually, now if you said Calypso, that's what you would have. You know, so instead of
maybe
Calypso, I put Lee in there, and it's Calypso.
Well, it's a definite kind of foreign influence on it. Let's hear it and see what happens.
Thank you.
Two tracks there, Calypso, and then from the album Cornbread, we heard Ciora, a nice slow ballad. Both of these were written by Lee Morgan.
Well, Ciora is actually what you'd call, like, it has a bossa nova beat behind it. And Ciora, a lot of people have asked me, who is Ciora? Ciora is a very...
Who is Ciora?
I'm glad you asked that. Ciora is the wife of one of my best friends. And she's always been after me, you know, for the last few years, telling me, you know, you write tunes for everybody else, and why don't you write something for me? And I used to tease her and tell her that I'm going to write old funky blues or something for her. But that's what I ended up writing, Ciora, and that is one of my favorite tunes. I like the chord pattern on it, and I just get a good feeling when I play on it. It's a quiet kind of thing, and you have to approach it kind of different, you know, and if you knew the woman Ciora, she has a melancholy thing, kind of very similar to the tune. Herbie Hancock plays a very beautiful solo on that.
Uh huh. Yeah, I noticed he's made appearances on more than one of your albums.
Yes, well, you know, he has been a Blue Note artist for the last few years, and there's so many of us right there on that label. That just about most of my favorite musicians just happen to be on the Blue Note label. This is not a plug or anything, but
no, it's true.
That's just the way it happens to be. Herbie, and
of course he's left now. He's
yeah,
gone
I understand nine. He just went to A&M. I understand.
Oh, was it A&M?
Yeah. But Wayne Shorter and Joe Henderson, Jackie McLean, they have a wealth of artists over there right now. Yeah. Usually it's not too hard to, although it's not necessary for you to have to, I mean, you know, I could use anybody I want to use. It's just that.
Do you always pick the men on your dates?
Oh, of course, I think everybody does. After
the,
all
the
your
producer
session.
Doesn't enter in.
That would be intolerable.
Yeah.
Not with jazz. A&R men and producers have a lot to do with a lot of rock and roll and deciding what tunes and what kind of music you should play, or maybe you should do this, the new Broadway show, or this or that. But they've come up with suggestions. A lot of times they have a lot of hip ideas, but as far as the music or the instrumentation, so far I've always had like more or less carte blanche. You know, I could do whatever I wanted to do. In fact, I don't think I could have really exist any other way, because I think it has to be left up to the musician's discretion who and what and why and where.
Right. Well, let's play a few tracks to, I know you got to get back out and do another set here. Play a few tracks from Karamba and Charisma, which are two of your most recent albums. I was noticing that Charisma, the one that just came out, I guess about 3 weeks ago, a month ago, was recorded back in '66.
Right.
What was the reason for that?
Well,
that it just came out.
They did that album, and it was a good album, you know. And this was just about the time where the acquisition was made from the change, when they were talking about changing over from Blue Note to Liberty, like I wanted to before.
To the big merge.
Right, and there was a little discrepancy as to just which records, you know, because the artists had a lot involved, because a lot of the artists' contracts were just about over, and a lot of them didn't want to go on to another company. I myself, at that time, I was right in the middle, because my contract was only about halfway, so I had to stay with them no matter who they went with until it was over, you know. Anyway, they went on and released Karamba and the Gigolo, but I always liked that Charisma album, and I kept on saying, well, what about that album, you know, because it's a drag, really. I think your music should be released as you make it.
Yeah, well, is it pretty much chronological except for this?
Yeah, well, it usually is, you know.
In other words,
I'm usually running a little bit behind merely because of I was making mere 4 albums as a leader a year. But it's very seldom that a record company will release them as fast as you make them. So before you know it, you might have a little backlog. See, this is something now I'm trying to watch out for. My new contract, I only make 2 a year from now on. That'll kind of slow things down, and I can really concentrate more on the music.
I see you're writing all the compositions now on your albums. There's at least a tendency towards that.
Yeah, well, it depends on these dates, you know. Sometimes I might do them all. Sometimes I might just do 1 or 2. You know, like now, for instance, Karamba. No, not Karamba. Let's say the Gigolo, for instance. Now they have a tune credited with me.
Uh-huh.
That's not really mine. I think it's the tune Trapped. Yeah, Trapped. Number 2. They had me down as the composer for 4 out of 5 tunes. The only one is You Go to My Head, which everybody knows is not mine, I guess. But Trapped wasn't mine either. That's a mistake. That should have been listed as Wayne Shorter, composer. And I think it's in his own publishing company, which would be Miyako Music.
Well, I'll make a note of that here. How do you like the big band in the background?
Oh, you mean that soundtrack?
Yeah.
Well, that's, I think that's them letting me know they want to hear some more music.
All right. Well, let's just wind up here. We'll play some selections from Karamba and Charisma. I want to thank you very much for giving an hour of time to us at KPFA.
Dan, it's been a pleasure.
And come on out here as soon as you can. You'll be here just through Saturday night or through Sunday night?
Well, we'll be here through Sunday.
So, all right. So, being that this is Saturday now, come in tomorrow night and check out Lee Morgan, because his group is just incredible. Just really vibrant and alive, and I'm trying to convince everybody I see to go see him, because it's even more exciting than his records, if that's possible.
Well, live music is always the best thing.
Well, it's out of sight anyway. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We heard Solita from the Lee Morgan album entitled Caramba on Blue Note, and then from Lee Morgan's newest album, Charisma, we heard The Double Up. Both compositions were written by Lee Morgan. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview. We'll do a few brief announcements now and tell you that the interview was recorded on Wednesday night over at the Bothan Jazz Club, and Lee Morgan will be appearing through just tomorrow night. Go by and see him. He's incredible.
Welcome back, and that was... rare archival interview with the legendary jazz trumpeter and composer Lee Morgan. Now we're going to move into Detroit's own Kenny Burrell. Let's listen to an interview with the legendary Kenny Burrell. Thank you.
with Kenny Burrell. He's been playing an engagement at the El Matador. And, of course, he's been around for many years playing numerous recording dates, probably the best-known jazz guitarist for record dates. Been playing, what, how many years now?
About 20, 21.
Well, where have you been playing these days?
All over the world lately, since June of last year, which is 69. I've been to Europe 4 times. I was in Japan this year for a tour. Not all over the world, but Japan and Europe and here.
And you travel with what usually?
Different groups. Once I went with my own quartet, and I went over with a package which included the Thad Jones Band, Jeremy Steig, Freddie Hubbard, myself, and I went over with the Newport Jazz All-Stars.
So you've been keeping real busy in that?
I've been traveling a lot more than I was before.
Uh-huh.
I mean, globally.
How about recording?
I'm going to do a few albums with Cadet coming up shortly, and I'm in the middle of negotiating with some other people, which I can't say right now, but I do have a commitment from Cadet to do a couple of albums.
Uh-huh. How did you like doing those old dates? Seemed like almost every Blue Note record that came out for a while, Jimmy Smith and... you know, so many dates back there where you were playing guitar. Was that just a short period of time, or?
That was from about 57 to about 63. It's about 6 years. I did a lot of recording. I guess I did more recording in those 6 years than anybody else in the business. Jazz recording and pop recording. Then I started going on the road in 63 as a result of the album called Midnight Blue.
Mm.
That sort of launched me into position where I could get my own group and go on the road.
And did he get a big hit off it, or?
Not really. The album just was a good album. It sold a lot, you know.
Thank you.
on those Blue Note dates, were things written out much for you, or did you just did you have all the charts in front, or did you just run it down with the group?
Both.
And I'm sure everyone was different, but
both ways. Sometimes the music was written. Sometimes we just a lot of times when Jimmy and I went in, Jimmy Smith and I, we just sort of said, well, what we're going to play, and we decided on a key and we started to play.
Sit around Rudy Van Gelder's for a few hours, I guess.
Yeah.
I used to have for my theme the Organ Grinder Swing, one of your best solos of all time.
Thank you.
How'd that one come about?
Well, Jimmy heard that tune from somewhere, and he came to the record date that day. He said, well, I've got to do this tune because I think it's been neglected and it will probably be a good seller. And we can do something with it. So we started out with Organ Grinder Swing as the focal point of the album. And everything else sort of evolved around that tune. Thank you.
find it easier to play in front of an audience or at a record date? Can you get off when you're playing at a recording
date? Doesn't matter, really. Except when the audience is noisy, it's kind of difficult to use any subtlety, even.
And you play a lot of ballads, too.
Yeah, I like ballads very much. But, you know, when you got all this distraction going on, it seems a waste when you try to do subtle things. But in the recording studio, it's nice. You can do what you want to do.
Do you think you can ever fully learn the guitar?
Well,
I mean, I think you have, but...
Yes and no. There's always something new to learn because the instrument is so, it's like a puzzle. There's so many different things you can do with such a small neck instrument with six strings. And like you got six strings across and you got, say, 25, 30 frets one way, and across that is six strings. So you got a combination of things going on there. And out of that combination of squares, there's a million possibilities. So there's always new possibilities.
Some of it's really mathematical.
Well, I'm talking about it that way, but I don't mean it. But the point is, it comes out to be there's always a new combination of places where you can put your fingers, and all of a sudden there's something new. So in that sense, you'll never learn it. It's not just what you do, but where you place it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might have the same combination put in a different place somehow. But on the other hand, learning the guitar or learning any instrument is learning to do what you hear. So that's the other part, which transcends the instrument. It applies to any instrument, to be able to play what you hear.
You mean inside?
Yeah.
Be able to just go...
Yeah, if you hear that and you play it.
Uh-huh.
So, I think I'm getting pretty close to that part.
Don't think you got that yet?
No, there's always something you hear you can't do.
Uh-huh.
Because you're always hearing new things, fortunately.
You ever dream about it? You ever dream up new things? What, you know, and
yeah,
then wake
I've done
up
that.
And do it?
I've done that in the middle of the night. But I'm kind of a lazy sleeper. I think I've gotten up once to say, oh yeah, let me try this. Usually I don't get out of bed to try something. It'll keep till tomorrow.
You taught yourself guitar, right?
Well, I'm teaching myself guitar. I started out as a result of my family, my brothers, my older brother, Billy, who's playing bass with me, by the way, this week. He switched to bass about 10 years ago. He was a guitar player. My father was a banjo player, non-professional. And I wanted to be a saxophonist when I started, but there was little money around. The guitar was, and I guess still is, the cheapest instrument you can buy. So I condescended to getting a guitar. And
how much is a good saxophone now? A really high quality.
I don't know.
I know a good guitar is like $1,000.
Yeah, but you can get a guitar for $10 too,
yeah,
in a pawn shop. And in fact, that's what my first guitar cost, $10. So I sort of started with that, and then the more I played it, the more I liked it. And then after about a year or so, I just said, well, okay, I'll go with this.
You never went back to
no,
the sax then?
No.
Do you play anything else now? Fiddle around on piano?
Yeah, I fiddle around on piano, and I fiddle around on bass. I have a piano at home, which I use for writing and arranging. But the only thing I can say that I'm capable on is the guitar.
Thank you.
that's one of my favorites of all time of yours. Don't mean a thing if it don't have that swing.
That's true.
Who's the other guitarist on that?
Barry Galbraith.
He's still around?
Yeah, he's working in the band on the David Frost Show. That's his basic gig right now with Billy Taylor. And he still does a lot of studio work in New York.
It seems like a lot of musicians have switched over to that.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of security if you're going to stay in New York or Los Angeles. I guess it affords you a schedule also besides a paycheck when you can have some regulated time for yourself. Because just doing studio work, freelancing is like being a doctor, you know, where you...
You're kind of waiting for people to come to you.
Yeah, and you don't have any schedule and your life is all consistently inconsistent.
Well, that was a large period of your life, for say those 6 years when you were doing those Blue Note dates.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was doing. And in 1960, I got so fed up with that erratic schedule that I took two Broadway shows. I did that for 3 years just so I could have a schedule. I worked in the pit band. Plus, I did record dates, but that was at least... I went to work every night at 8 o'clock, and I finished at 11. And
you had a chart to follow, right?
Yeah. That was all right. It was. I did a lot of reading, a lot of thinking there.
Uh-huh.
A lot of practicing. I thought of that as an incubation period for me, because I really got my mind together while I was sitting there for those 3 years, doing not much musically, but sort of thinking about what I wanted to do in the future. Then I proceeded to try to do it.
Have you heard John McLaughlin?
Yeah.
He has a lot of rock background.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily playing in public, but in private, do you ever try new things or some of the things that he's doing or other, you know, do you ever try to play rock? Or?
Well, I've played rock on a lot of record dates, which you're probably not aware of. I've been doing that for a long time, you know, before it became an arty form of expression, and I say that in quotes. I see no sense in experimenting with things just in order to keep up. Like I said before, I'm not trying to keep up with it. I'm aware of it. And if I really feel something that I hear, maybe John will play, then I will do it, because that's my philosophy, you know. No matter where I've heard it or what its source, it comes out of me sort of like because I can't help it to come out. But I don't sit down and like, okay, well, here's a new puzzle, I'm going to work this out. I don't approach music that way. It's got to be like more feeling than anything else, for whatever that's worth. I don't know.
Well, what kind of rock dates did you do? Was your name not listed on the albums, things
mm-hmm.
that I wouldn't know about?
No, because I felt that it would, it would confuse whatever image I had as a jazz player. And I knew that someday the two would get closer, and it'll probably get closer and closer, where, and I hope it will, then we can get rid of the labels.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so we're talking about John McLaughlin today as a rock guitarist. I don't know, maybe 5 years from now, there'll be a guitarist we'll be talking about. And you won't know what to call him, because the bridge will be completely there and solid. You know?
Closed, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm looking forward to that day, because I think a guy, if he can play, he can play. And we should really get rid of those labels. Thank you.
comes when you listen to somebody like, not jumping back too far, but jumping back to, say, Django Reinhardt or Charlie Christian or even some people used to play rhythm with Fats Waller. Can you still get things out of them?
I get a lot of pleasure out of it and appreciation, understanding. And well, from a musician's point of view, you get a lot of things from listening.
Uh-huh.
Those are some of my early influences.
Who else did you used to listen to that probably...
Well, you mentioned two, Christian and Reinhardt, with Oscar Moore, who played with Nat Cole, was a big influence as far as guitar. Then there's a whole string of people that had nothing to do with guitar that influenced me. Art Tatum, for one, Miles, Bird, Duke Ellington, Dizzy. People I've worked with, John Coltrane.
You
influence all the time by things. And you see, there's varying degrees of how much you will be influenced and how much you will influence in turn.
Well, I'm sure you've turned on a million jazz guitars, too.
I don't know about that, but if I have, I hope it's been a good thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, whatever I mean by a good thing.
Well, you have a whole style of playing that, you know, sounds bluesy without, it has its own kind of thing. Like, you don't bend strings much. You get blues chords instead of bending strings.
Well, like I said before, that's my bent, right?
Right.
My bent is not too bent.
Uh-huh.
But that's just a personal thing. Some people sound a certain way. Like, when we talk, music is almost like talking anyway. Some people turn their words away a certain way, and other people don't. That's their sound. You know?
Uh-huh.
And that's the way I hear it, so that's the way it comes out.
Thank you.
Welcome back, and that was Detroit's own Kenny Burrell from an interview from 1970, and that's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, June 16th, 2024. And if you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website, and that's at the Pan-African Radio Network. You can reach the Pan-African Radio Network by logging on to blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. And June is Black Music Month, so we're going to continue with a focus on some of the legendary and outstanding African-American and African musicians from throughout the world. We'll close out with another legendary jazz artist, and that's Horace Silver. This is from an album entitled Serenade to a Soul Sister from 1968. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.